exit number 12093, real one.
Mr. Topless, real one. Whereabouts do you come from, please?
A little place called Burrowley Marsh in Lincolnshire. About 3 miles from the seaside town of Skegness.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a farm owner in partnership with his brother.
And did you go to school in
Skegness? I went to school in Skegness until I reached the age of 14. Ordinary Church of England school, which is normally nowadays called a council school.
What did you do when you left school?
When I left school, my first job was on a local farm. At that time, my father had left his own business and through bankruptcy proceedings, and I went to work on a farm 3 miles from my home as an ordinary labourer for the magnificent sum of 7 and 6 a week.
How did you come to be in the army then?
I didn't join the army until I was 19 years of age. During the my time of work from 26 to 30, the employment in the seaside town was very little, only about 4 months of the year. The last job I had before I joined the army was with the Billy Butler in the amusement people, who at that time had just taken over the amusement park in Skegness. I was out of work for the last 9 months after Butlin's amusement had closed down, and decided that with the 9 other members of the family, plus mother and father, that it would be best if I left home and tried to make my way and to relieve the burden on the family itself. Just before I left home, we had completed the whole family building our own house, which to this day is still standing, a concrete and steel erection. It took us about 18 months to build, and in the meantime we had to make our own livings, and which we did by running a market garden attached to the plot of land where we built the house. It was tough at times, but we lived off the land. We kept a pig or two, and we killed our own pig. We cured our own bacon. The garden produced everything we required in the way of vegetables and such like. But we had to have money coming in, and that's the reason why the boys and the girls left home, left and took out jobs locally, and on two occasions I left home for short periods, such as harvesting of sugar beet and such like. But everyone in the family had to make donations to the family coffer, which was the only way you lived in those days. We tried our hand at running a shop in the house when it was built, but bad debts and such like caused it to close down. And that's one of the reasons why I said, well, I'm getting nowhere, I'm 19, and I had received one or two pamphlets about the British forces, and I thought, well, I'm physically fit, I'm a pretty good gymnast, I served 8 years with the local boys brigade, and I asked for papers and received a call up to Lincoln Barracks.
So it was easy to get in?
Well, yes, it was very easy to get in. The only thing was that my education wasn't all that great. But I was very fortunate the recruiting sergeant happened to know my uncle, who served with during the First World War. And part of my entrance exam was done by the recruiting sergeant himself. I could speak normally, I could read, I could take dictation and such like, but mathematically I was pretty much of a duffer. I could add 2 and 2, make 4. It was on my benefit I could make 5 out of them, but otherwise I was a local boy that wasn't interested in school, more interested in the countryside, and most of my truancy was more or less to walk across the country to learn nature more than anything. I was really interested in the natural phenomena and fauna of the countryside. But if you know Lincolnshire, it's where I was born, it's you have to go at least 10 miles before you get into anything like a 1 in 60 grade or hill. But I love the countryside, and when I joined the army, I came down to a totally different countryside. I came down from Lincoln Barracks to a little place called Bovington Camp in Dorset, and I wonder where the hell I'd got to. But it was an eye-opener to me. I arrived there at 7 o'clock in the evening, and I woke up in the morning to ice on the washing up bowls, and somebody shouted, "Get out of the beds, you're in the army now." And from then on, my life was one complete round of activity. For 9 months, I went through every phase of military manoeuvre, and at the same time, I learnt more about engines than I'd ever learnt in my life. Although I'd previously, with my brother and I, we had built our own T-model Ford engines and such like, but I learnt the basics of engineering until I eventually achieved the passing out to marks of about 98% on the course. That was after 9 months training.
So you were in the Royal Tank Corps?
Yeah.
What did you think of the recruits' training, how you were treated?
Well, I think it was pretty tough at times, because you're expected to go from a gymnastic point of view to a military point of view in a space of minutes. You're in the KD shorts, or rather gym shorts, at 9:35, and at 9:40 you have to be in probably full marching order. You learn to take shortcuts. You learn the art of making things look right when you knew they weren't right, military speaking. In other words, you had to make sure that your instructors didn't realise the fact you've got no socks on or no shirt underneath your tunic, which you should have. Those are the things you learn. You learn how to be quick, decisively quick. And you learn not to answer back. My instructors are very fair, especially the junior ranks of the instructor, like the corporal and the lance corporal. The squad sergeant himself was quite a good military man. He knew his job, but he applied the military rules very strictly. But then again, he was fair. But the lance corporal and the full corporal, they were the boys that you talked to, more or less. I'm talking to you now. If you had any problems, they'd listen. And then if the problem was such that they couldn't deal with it, then they would go through the sergeant to as far as a commanding officer. Pardon me. Your life is from Rivali to last post, and it wasn't a bad life.
So you didn't regret joining the army?
I never regretted joining the army, no. I had a wonderful life, really, because I was my own man. I made of military life what I wanted out of it. I won't say I went through 6 year peacetime service without committing a crime. I did, but I wasn't detected. You break military laws without taking a breath, really, or with every breath you take you can break a military law, but unless somebody sees you, and then you get away with it. I did enjoy the physical side, the sporting side of army life. I played football regular 2 and 3 times a week. At one time I ran the garrison football league. That was in later years after my military training. And we had our own cycling professionally unit, we also had a good boxing team. And in fact, I 36 and 37 at the Tank Corps Depot, I was regimental champion at the weight of welterweight, and I have the at the moment two trophies in the local museum, the Royal Tank Museum. But that was a life that you had to, you didn't knuckle down to things, but you had to work with it. If you worked against it, you had a hell of a life. But if you worked with it, you were treated like a man. And that's something that I'd never been treated before in my life. I've been treated more like a country bumpkin.
You mean you were treated with respect in the army?
Oh, yes. Yeah, you were treated with respect. You were given a job to do and you were left to do it. You didn't have a man stand over with a whip all the time or coming along and knocking money out your wages. The British Army was, I think, the finest institution that any person could really join in peacetime, because it made you into a man, it taught you to be a man. And even to this day, 79, I would advocate any youngster, really, if he really wants to do something, make something for himself, get his attain the self-respect of people who are probably his superiors in their life, but he can join them as superiors. And the British Army is the finest method, I think, of teaching youngsters how to be men.
Were you being trained as a tank driver?
I've been trained as a member of the Royal Tank Corps at the time, which the actual initial training of 9 months, it taught you how to maintain military vehicles, both wheeled and tracked, and also to drive them. Fortunately, I had a lot of experience with driving before I joined the army, and that's the reason why I had such a good record after my training period. But once you get to your service unit, mine was at the 2nd Battalion in Farnborough, you're given specific jobs to do. My first job was actually as a sergeant's mess waiter. There I was fortunate in making friends with a RQMS technical man, and he said, well, you're a silly boy, he said, doing this sort of job. He said, I know I like my pint of beer in the morning after the night before, but he said, why don't you go in the mechanical side? And I said, how? He said, well, he said, I'll recommend you for a driver mechanics course, which, if you pass, will mean not only extra pay, he said, but also a lot more privileges. So at the age of 20, I sat the driver mex course at the local ordnance factory and passed first time and received the dubious honour of being the youngest serving driver mechanic in the Royal Tank Corps at that time. From the 2nd Battalion, I went on the first manoeuvres, actually, with the 2nd Battalion Salisbury Plain in 1935. We had done one in 34, which was a very small manoeuvre. In 35, we went on the what we call the tactical manoeuvres instigated by Brigadier Hobart, which taught us the infiltration warfare, which we later came across in the war in France.
What did that consist of?
That consisted of armoured columns penetrating through defences and wandering at will over the territorial, which was not defended, and it surrounding the enemy forces with superior weight and numbers. after the this manoeuvre, we returned to Farnborough, and
how did those manoeuvres go? Did they go without hitch?
They were, from my estimation of them, they were the most outstanding aspect of war anyone could visualise. It was something new. Before, a tank during the First World War had just battered its way through opposition, and by sheer weight of numbers and surprise, they breached the front line. But this was mobile warfare. There were no trenches. There were only opposing forces. And you're in a country that... supposedly, you're in a country that... couldn't find a static line. So therefore, you roamed at random, kept your eyes open and your guns poised and clobbered the enemy wherever you met him. And in the meantime, you had to also defend yourself from air attacks and such like, and use your camouflage experience to avoid detection, because no army, no mobile army can go far until it's replenished. And the replenishment vehicles were this, the impression of all mobile transport in the southwest of England. Every firm, every bus company had vehicles impressed for the 6 weeks of the manoeuvres, and were used as supply units, ammunition trucks, everything. And this colossal column broke through enemy lines and just fanned out in various directions, the armour first, then the supply units coming afterwards. And the same sort of tactic that Hitler used in France when he broke through the Moselle and attacked the British troops there, the Allied troops there.
Were there any incidents that happened to you on those manoeuvres that you can recount?
Only on one occasion, when I was driving a light tank from the Savernack Forest back to Tidworth, and I had a young officer with me, and we sheared a driving shaft, and I spent 12 hours in a bit of Salisbury Plain. No wireless, because the tanks didn't have wireless in them days, and just had to sit down and wait till somebody came along and brought a recovery vehicle. We finished up smoking woodbines. I smoked all these players and finished up smoking woodbines, and eventually rescued about 4 o'clock in the morning. It was a hilarious affair. The same officer I had later on at Bovington Camp, teaching him how to drive medium tanks. He was a supplementary reserve officer and had joined the forces there on these manoeuvres, and was later accepted in the army after he passed his officer's course at Bovington. And I had the honour of teaching him to drive the medium tanks as we had then in the army.
Did you come across Hobart at that time?
No, I didn't meet General Hobart as he was until a demonstration at Bovington, when they brought out a special type tank called the individual 16-ton tank. It had one main turret and two small turrets, armed with one 3-pounder gun and two machine guns. And I met General Hobart because I was acting as a reserve driver for this tank at Bovington, and the general came along, met all the men of the crew. Actually, there's 5 men in the crew, and shook us all by the hand and thanked us for our services.
What kind of a man was he?
From the brief meeting I had with him, and to hear him say that I think he was the most brilliant tactician that the army had at that date. He inventive. Some of the machinery he gave his name to design, such as the oscillating platform for training, which taught a man how to fire a gun from a moving vehicle against a moving vehicle without actually being in the tank itself. Hobart was an inventor as well as just a brilliant tactician, and if he'd been with the military forces in France in the early part of the war, he might have had some answers to the German columns.
What happened to you after these manoeuvres that you remember?
Well, I stayed at Bovington Camp until November 37 when I came out on the reserve. And actually, I came out on the reserve because one thing, I had met the lady who's my wife now, and being under 26 years of age, I couldn't get married in the army, and so I came out more or less to get married, and decided to come out, settle down in the area, which my military sojourn in the area had taught me to love Dorset more than I did Lincolnshire. And I took a job locally as a gardener to a lady in a private house, and was there until the 1st of September 39 when I was mobilised, and we turned to Bovington Camp to carry on for the duration of the war. And I only saw home twice during the next 6 years.
How did you feel about being recalled to the colours?
Well, we knew it was coming. I'd been called up in early 39, well, June 39, for a refresher course at Tidworth Barracks. And at the same time, I was having my house built, or my bungalow built, and I was told then by the assessing officer that it would probably be the last chance we had of recapitulating our military expertise, such as driving, gunfighting, and such like, as within they expected within then, within about 6 months, we would be at war. The war didn't come suddenly on the 3rd of September. It didn't happen all at once. It was been built up over the months. Even I, as an ordinary civilian then, could see that something was happening in Europe, and something would happen. And I wasn't really surprised when I got called back.
Had the equipment changed much?
The equipment hadn't changed a great deal at all. We still went back to 3-pounder guns on the medium tanks. They'd brought out two tanks at that time, the A9 and the Mark 1 I tank. Mark 1 I tank, in fact, had a less armament than the old medium training tank. It only had a 4-5 machine gun. And the regiment I joined then, which was 4th Royal Tank Regiment, was equipped with the Mark 1 I tank. And those tanks we took to France with us.
What did you think to the tanks which you had at that time?
Well, we thought they were quite good, really. But the first time we saw a French tank and a German tank, we were astounded at the difference in the in the weight, the armour and such like that we came across. We only went into one real battle, the Battle of Arras, and we lost all our tanks then. The fact that the French had put in an attack from the opposite direction and failed to make the rendezvous.
Can we go through the Battle of Arras in detail, as far as you remember it, step by step, please?
Well, I didn't actually take part in the tank battle itself. At that time, I was on the ammunition wagon with the 4 tons of tank shells and such like, back at a pithead at Lons, and we got the call to revitalise the tanks. And we went forward under cover of darkness onto the Arras plain and searched for about an hour and could find no surviving tanks. And then we recalled back to our immediate leaguer and told to stand by for move-off.
Which squadron were you in?
I was in HQ squadron at the time.
Who was your commanding officer there?
I can't remember the commanding officer's name. He didn't come back with us. He got caught on the wounded on the boat coming back from Dunkirk. We rather fortunately came away from the quay, but just out, off Calais, we were shelled and machine gunned by Messerschmitts, and arrived in Dover with about 80 members of our regiment either wounded or dead.
What was the machine gunning like?
It was hell, really. I was fortunate. I got down tin hats against a bulkhead, and all I got was the shrapnel from the cannon shells. I found out later that the bulkhead itself was a locker full of high explosive shells. It was the used for the gun gun on the platform above. It wasn't my time. I didn't get injured. I did see one of the most astounding things in my life I've ever seen. I saw 8 Grenadier Guardsmen stand on the deck, rifles pointed in the air and firing as fast as they could the aeroplanes as they came over. And those 8 men never got a scratch. They never hit a plane, but they never got a scratch. And when we arrived at Dover, the guardsmen marched off in fours. Their buttons were bright, their boots were clean, and they were every inch a soldier as when anyone knows of a guardsman, they expect of the British soldier. But from my point of view, I thought it was foolhardy, because a 303 rifle is no match against a Messerschmitt, because it moves too fast, and the speed of a 303 rifle bullet, it will never catch a Messerschmitt, because the Messerschmitt is a little bit faster than the bullet. But it was an incident that I thought was outstanding. I'd love to have had a camera to take it.
Had some NCO or officer told them to do this?
I think it was a natural instinct to hit back. We were being shelled. We had 10 minutes of hell with three or four Messerschmitts, and they just went backwards and forwards over the boat. And I think it's just a reaction. You've got your head down. All I had was a 3.8 revolver, which is no good to anybody. But these boys had the rifles, and they thought, well, why the hell should I catch it and not ever go myself? They were fortunate, as I said, never got a scratch.
What was the name of the ship that you went across on?
I've never been able to ascertain correctly whether it was a Mona's Isle. I heard it was a Mona's Isle, then somebody said it was the Isle of Wight steam packet. But things were so chaotic that I don't think anybody in the regiment really knew what the actual name of the boat was.
Going back to the Arras counterattack, why was it that you didn't take a fuller part in that?
Well, I wasn't in the actual fighting force itself. I was on what they call the BS song, the supply column. The tanks had put in the attack. And according to what I heard from one or two of the drivers that came back, they just stood no chance at all. They just had the tracks shot away from them, and of course the Mark 1 I tank had exposed tracks and just had the tracks shot away from them, and they had to abandon straight away.